Hello, my name is Mark Taylor, and welcome to the Education on Fire podcast. The place for creative and inspiring learning from around the world. Listen to teachers, parents and mentors share how they are supporting children to live their best, authentic life and are proving to be a guiding light to us all. Hello, welcome back to the Education on Fire podcast. Great to be back with you as always. Many thanks to the National Association for Primary Education, who are continued supporters and sponsor of the show. There's links in the description about where you can find out more and also some of their latest videos. Now, today I'm delighted to be chatting to Jenna Edwards. Now, growing up in the middle of the cornfields of Minnesota, Jenna had some big dreams. She wanted to make people laugh on TV, inspire change and travel the world. Life wasn't easy though. She was born to teenage parents who split when she was three, and Jenna faced poverty and abuse until her mums took a stand and they escaped. Now, Jenna believes in the power of optimism and the idea that there are a million ways to do anything. She now owns her own media company where she is focused on sharing stories that reflect the resilience of human spirit, the triumph of positivity and the extraordinary beauty of optimism, in which each story highlights different ways that people can overcome these obstacles standing in the way of their dreams. Now, we have a fascinating conversation about her life and how she's got to this point, but also about a fabulous new book, Aggressive Optimism. So I really hope you enjoy this, plus the fact that she's come up with a great way of being able to describe us as people involved in Education on Fire. I hope you really enjoy this, my conversation with Jenna Edwards. Hi, Jenna. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Education on Fire podcast. I love talking to people who've got multifaceted careers. I like talking to people who've had different experiences in life. And I love people who are just sort of a shining example of what's possible. And I think that's so exciting for children to hear and also for us as parents and educators as well. So we can kind of really embody that to sort of support children to grow into what they need to be. So yeah, thanks so much for being here.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So why don't we start off with that kind of, well, say multifaceted career. Let's start off in terms of that journey, in terms of sort of, you know, how did it all start, so to speak, and sort of take us into where you want to go from here. And I'll sit back and then I'll come back again in an hour or so.
Where's my popcorn? Right. It's so funny. You're like, I love people with multifaceted careers. I'm like, well, you're going to love me. One of my favorite movies of all time is Wayne's World. I know, it's so random. But there's this quote in there at the beginning of the movie where he's like, I've had plenty of Joe jobs, but nothing I'd call a career. Let me put it to you this way. I have an extensive collection of name tags and hairnets. and so it's basically how I roll. Yes. And there are a couple jobs that some of my friends don't even believe were real, like egg candling was a job I had when I was a teenager. I grew up in a really small town in the middle of a cornfield in Minnesota. And egg candling was a job that you could get over the summer. And it was disgusting. And I hated it. And it just added to this burning desire for me to move to California. Like, I've had it since I was 3 years old. In my little feety pajamas, telling my mom and dad, like, I want to move to California. And their response was constantly, it's going to fall in the ocean. And my reply was, beachside property. It's totally fine.
It's a lot of land to fall into the ocean as well, isn't it? That's the thing.
I know. It's not a small state. since I was three, like, my whole dream was to move to California and be an actress. And I started in choir in my school. And I came out here and I learned a lot growing up in Minnesota because I had so many different jobs. And, like, you know, I was working at 13, you know, just doing things to help out around the house. And that work ethic served me really well. Mm-hmm. And I think I just have a curious spirit. And so I'm constantly like, ooh, let's try that thing. So when I moved out here, I started acting and it was magic. Everything I could have hoped for. And I booked a role on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it was my favorite show at the time. So I thought my career was going to take off. And about a month after it aired, and I was flying high thinking all my dreams are going to come true, I was involved in a really horrific car crash that gave me post-traumatic stress disorder, so I couldn't read. And I stuttered when I talked. Two very important things if you're acting. And so I thought my life was over. I thought my career was over. I thought it was going to be that way forever. I was actually told by a doctor that I was going to have these symptoms of flashbacks and panic attacks and hyperventilating until I passed out and nightmares and just all the things that were happening to me. I was told were going to be my life forever. And I was like, this sucks. You know? And so I, through that whole experience, learned a lot of tips, tricks, and ways to deal with emotions and psychological things and all of that. And when I healed from the PTSD, I started producing. So it moved me in this direction of being behind the camera and organizing things that way. And that led to like wanting to tell stories and help people. So I started speaking at high schools and then COVID hit. And so I've done all of this stuff. And throughout that entire process, I've wanted so badly to write a book and was being told, and I think this is important to hear, throughout the entire like 15 years from healing from post-traumatic stress disorder to deciding to do the book, there were a lot of well-meaning people advising me on how I should write it, what it should be, you know, and you get that, especially when you're a teenager, right? You're told like, this is how you should do the thing that you want to be doing. And it was kind of like writing this book. It's called Aggressive Optimism. I have a copy. and we'll talk more about it because I think it's important. It's got a lot of really cool stories that I think your audience is going to like. But my point in all of this is through PTSD and going through all of those challenges, I think I developed this confidence in myself to understand like how I operate, which I think is the most important thing we as humans can figure out across the board, is just like what works for us. There's a million ways to do anything. What is it that, how can we do the thing where it aligns with what we want to do, you know, who we want to impact and how we want to do it to bring us joy. So I ended up writing it as a novel for teenagers, and I couldn't be happier. And so I don't know if that answered your question about multifaceted, but it's like just – I just do the things, Mark.
Yeah, I think it really does. And it just reminds me of a story. When I was at music college, the one thing I found tricky was the fact that I'm surrounded by these brilliant people, and my professors worked in the London orchestras and session musicians, and – it was kind of, I need to be them in order to do the thing. And it was only when I realized that they're different personalities, they are different sort of skill sets, but there was a thread of something which was sort of their individuality and the idea of what music was and that kind of thing, which when I sort of tapped into that and realized, ah, so my version of that feels like that to me, and I don't need to look like this or sound like this or do this. Yes. Of course, you're going to get the skills that you need and you're going to take on some of those things. But actually, it was that, like exactly what you said, you know, when I realized my version of this of me was going to give me the joy that I wanted, which then takes you on to the success or the career or whatever it is that you're trying to do, life gets so much easier at that point, does it? And I think sharing
it really does. Oh my gosh, it really does. And I also think it's like so important. I have to constantly remind myself, especially with social media, like, No, just because that's working for them doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Like the only thing that works in any of this is setting a goal and working diligently every day on achieving that goal. Whatever that looks like for you, however it you can stick with that goal is the way, right? But I think we have like, at least my social media feed is inundated with how-to courses and like you know, all of that kind of stuff, because I love it. And it's my preferred form of procrastination, if I'm being completely honest. Like, I love to be like, well, I don't know if I'm doing this correctly, so I'm going to take a class. No, just do the thing, right?
I'm relating.
But I think it's, you reminded me of something that is really important and why I wrote, like, the book isn't just a story of, like, it doesn't start with the crash and then go into the healing. It begins with me as a teenager. And the reason I did that was because I really want kids, teens, I call them kids, because I'm old, forgive me. But these students and young people, I want them to understand, like, to honor their desires in a way that's productive. And for me, that was, I absolutely hated where I grew up. It was so hard for me. I didn't feel like I belonged. I hadn't found my place. I hadn't found my people. It was before the internet. Like, there wasn't, I mean, the nearest mall was 30 miles away. It was literally a 2-mile square in the middle of a cornfield with 2006 people who were lovely in their own way, but also very small town, Midwest, small-minded, like, you know. And it, the funny thing is, it was mostly the parents that were, like, influencing their kids to be just kind of, like, horrible humans sometimes. Like, my parents were also musicians, and I write about that in the book too. And it was the 80s, so of course it was like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Clearly they're, you know, a bad influence, even though they were, like, my house was the sober house, and like, we didn't have any parties. And it was the opposite of what everybody, like, kind of put on us as far as reputation is concerned. And I just had this desire to be not there, to the point where I started to, like, look for ways to get out in a productive way. And I found exchange student programs. So I got to go to Thailand my senior year and experience that. And I went to Japan my freshman year of college and experienced that. And so I feel like when we're feeling trapped, if we can put on what I call a mindset of aggressive optimism, it just trigger something in you to think of ways to productively get out of that situation. You know what I mean?
And I think also for me, what I'm finding fascinating is the fact that we're now talking pre-car crash. We're talking about, you know, you had this mindset, you wanted to do what you wanted to do, you then did move, you then did get your sort of dream job, in inverted commas. And so it's really interesting that you kind of had that within you, and then yet, like, say, as your life changed after that and the experiences you had to get into the point of sharing the book. So can you just sort of tell me a little bit about what's the common thread of both of those, you know, that person that's true in both of those scenarios, and then maybe what changed, and then kind of, I don't know, did it change your mindset, or did it, was the mindset already there but your perception was different having had that experience?
I think, great question. No one's ever asked me that. So I have this story that I tell about when I was like 11 years old, I want to say, maybe younger. I was with my grandpa at this fair, like an amusement park, and we were standing in line. It was super hot, and hot in Minnesota is also humid and sticky and mosquito-y and gross. And so it was like kind of miserable experience in that way. And he was like such a trooper. I'll just, like, this is such a precious memory to me. But it was the moment where something clicked in me that changed my entire life. And so we're standing in line, and the line's super long, but it's not as long as it could be, right? And so he starts complaining, even though he doesn't want to. And I, like, turn around in my little kid voice, and I'm like, but it could be, you know, we could be back there, like 5 rows back. And he says to me, wow, you really are an eternal optimist. And at that time, I didn't know what that meant. I had no clue what optimism was, but the pride he felt in saying these words to me will stick with me forever. And so after I, you know, as I grew, that word came into my being more and more, and I started to grab a hold of it. And I really am an eternal optimist. And so what that means to me is, like, I'm not always in a good mood, y'all. Let me just tell you, I get a little saucy, a little spicy. And that's fine. Optimism is just a belief that you can figure it out, that things can get better, but you have to put in the work. And the aggressive optimism mindset is like acknowledging where you're at. So that's the piece that came in after the crash. I was always this optimist, right? Where I was like, okay, well, let's figure it out. And I grew up without the internet. So I didn't have this like amazing ability to like actually research things to figure it out. So like the exchange program was because I just happened to be in a room with someone talking about their experience as an exchange program. And I was like, I want to do that, you know, and then I figured out how to do it. So Marie Forleo actually has a book that's called Everything is Figureoutable. And it's very like, I love that title so much because it is. And after the crash, the thing that changed was learning to be okay with myself when I wasn't okay. And learning to not beat myself up and kind of remove emotion from this like super emotional mental injury, I call it, right? And so that's kind of where that aggressive optimism piece came in. Like the optimism was always there, but like the aggressive part was, I mean, I literally couldn't control my thoughts. You know, like the chemistry in my brain was so out of whack that I am not kidding when I say if I closed my eyes, someone died. And so I didn't close my eyes for 8 months and I ended up in the hospital, right? So there's like all of this stuff, but acknowledging where I was and not judging it and believing wholeheartedly that I could figure out how to move forward was the thing that like changed everything for me.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, I think that's kind of the essence of almost everything related to anything that you want to do, and the essence of understanding life in general, because your brain, whether you have an injury or whether it's just day to day, is going to be giving you all sorts of thoughts, all sorts of things. It might be traumatic. It might just be that, you know, growing up, this is what you deem to be how life should be because that's all you've experienced and what you've done. And as soon as you can separate that out and just see, okay, this is my brain doing this thing, it's not the essence of me, it's not what I'm sort of here to do, then immediately that separation, I think, really gives you a skill set, but an understanding of innately who you are as a human and where that can take you. And I think the second part of that is, like, I know you talk about the idea of positivity as opposed to optimism, and I think that really sort of resonates from what you were saying, because just saying everything's fine and I'm okay and, you know, it'll all be okay when you're feeling in the depths of something is not real. Whereas the way you just described it, you can have both of those things at the same time. And I think people are probably unaware, but also maybe scared of being in that particular situation.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, sometimes, like, what do they call it? Radical responsibility. Or like having a come to Jesus moment with yourself, it can be real scary. Like for me at the time, you know, I write about it in the book and I tell it in a very, like, I call the book Girl Interrupted Meets Legally Blonde. And I just want everybody to know, like, it's a novel. It's not like everything is fictionalized. And there's a character in there that her name is Jessa and she's the villain. And people are always like, ooh, who's Jessa based on? And I'm like, she's based on a lot of people, right? Like, basically, it was like these experiences that I had, but also the mean part, honestly, was my internal voice more than anything. It's almost like when we're going through these things and it's scary, our defense mechanism, at least mine, is to beat myself up for even having these thoughts and experiences. And that just perpetuates the thoughts and experiences. And it's just this spiral of like not helpfulness, you know? And so I feel like in those moments, we really have to like stop and recognize like, are part of it, if we're, and we have to say, is this true? Like, is this actually the truth? Am I really trapped here? Like for me, yeah, I was. Before I got my license, I was trapped in this little 2 mile square town. And yet you have to remember it's not forever, right? It's like, okay, right now I am. What can I be doing that will set myself up for success in the future? It's certainly not saying mean things to myself. That's not going to help. But like studying and figuring out how to get into an exchange program, for example, or figuring out how to be an actor in LA, or figuring out how to be a musician. Like these are all things that you can research and figure out. Like other people have done them, so therefore it is possible. And I think that that's probably the most important thing when we're feeling like we don't belong and we're feeling like we're trapped. First of all, we have to ask ourselves, is this true? If it is, am I helping the situation? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Because that's the control part that we actually have, right? Like right now, I have a job. It's probably someone's dream job. And so I feel awful saying it's not my dream job. And I have to constantly remind myself, like, it's giving me the opportunity to publish this book. It's giving because it's paying my bills, because it's doing XYZ, right? But it's not going to be forever if I don't want it to be. And that's the radical responsibility on my part. And I feel like it's so important that we keep reminding ourselves and our kids that this is how to be functional in society.
And the optimism of that comes through again, because it's that you don't even necessarily know what all those steps are. Like you say, if it's that kind of, I want to study, okay, well, where am I going to study? You know, is that who's the person that maybe is going to give me that bit of inspiration or put me onto that piece of literature or introduce me to this person or realize that there is an exchange program that I might be able to do? Because it's all very well saying I'm going to save up and buy a ticket to LA, but you know, there are a few steps in there, or there's a few different ways of doing that. One might just be having the patience to grow and not be 10 anymore. You know, I need to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever it happens to be. And so I think understanding all of that and knowing that within these sort of broad sweeps of what you want to do, the minutiae of what's possible, just be aware of that there. And I think that when the optimism comes in, you know, I'm going to meet the person I need to meet at the right time, and actually understanding that all the little breadcrumbs and all the little stones that you need to sort of step on to get somewhere will materialize. And I think the more you are the way that you're explaining about, the more likely they are to become clear, because the other option of that is to say, I can't get out of here, there are no options, I'm never going to be any different. And then that's what you see as well. And that sort of both sides of the coin, I think, is important to understand.
100%, right? What do they say? What we focus on grows.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
It's super true. And people think that that's like a woo-woo statement, but the reality is, like, you get to choose how you spend your time. And if that time is sitting in your bed thinking about the thing that's making you anxious, you're focusing on that. That's a choice that you get to make. Not that anxiety disorder isn't real. I'm saying, like, in the moment, there are tools and tips and tricks to break you out of that cycle. And this is the other thing that I really would love for people to, like, hone in on. And that is, those tips and tricks to break you out of those cycles are different for everybody. So the commitment to growing and learning and achieving that dream that you have might be taking time to figure out which tip, trick, or tool works for you first, right? Like for me, I think this is a great example. So growing up, I grew up in Minnesota. And I know that you're across the pond and probably don't know what that means, but it's basically it. There was this show in the 80s called Little House on the Prairie. Have you heard of it?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, it's set in Minnesota, and it's set probably 2 hours from where I grew up. And that city that had the mall 30 miles away from me was Mankato, which was the city in the show that they would take like 3-day trips to go like get their supplies, right? So growing up in the area where Laura Ingalls grew up and where she, you know, journaled all these amazing stories and stuff, like put journaling as this, like, what do you call it? This just magical way of processing information and sharing your life and all of that stuff. And so, y'all, I was determined to be a journaler. Like, I would buy these beautiful journals. I'm still a little bit obsessed with journals, just so you know. I love going to the bookstore and like picking out the perfect journal for the mood that I'm in. And it's a really expensive habit I don't recommend. But anyway, I digress. So I'll never forget it. I was like determined to be a journaler, but I was bad at it. It was just not something I actually enjoyed doing. So I enjoyed buying the journal. I enjoyed opening the journal. I enjoyed the first entry to the journal, and then the journal would sit. And I'm kind of type A. And so if I was like on a kick to start a new journal, I would have to get a brand new one, even though there's still like 100 pages empty in the one that I bought, but it's been on the shelf for 3 months. The dates won't be sequential. It's a problem. So I had on my shelf probably 30 journals with maybe 20 pages in each filled in. And my husband now, he wasn't my husband at the time, comes home and I'm producing this movie, and you should have seen my desk. It was bonkers, y'all. It was like post-it notes everywhere, pieces of paper everywhere, all this stuff. And then like on the shelf, my neatly stacked journals. And he goes to me just unassumingly, why don't you put your to-do list in the journals? Pew. Head explosion, life-changing moment. I cannot explain to you how big of a deal this was. So I started writing all of my to-dos in my journals, and everything changed for me. And I tell that story because, like, some people will talk about journaling being this like key to unlocking things. I'm a verbal processor. My key to unlocking things is to talk at my husband because he's still kind of sleeping during morning coffee and like process that way and write to-do lists because that's how I achieve my goals. And it was so cool too because he was like, then you'll have a way to track your goals, but you'll also have a historic record of what you did. So it is kind of journaling in that traditional sense. But that's what I mean by it, like taking time to figure out which tools actually work for you is going to be life-changing.
Yeah.
And that's what you get to do when you're in school, right? Like when you're quote trapped in the situation, you get to explore all the tools. And I wish I was your age so that I could.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love that. So in which case, following that on, how did the idea and how did you go about actually writing a novel? I'm assuming because of the producing and the storytelling idea that would formulate. But from what you're explaining, it would make sense. I could, you know, the self-help book, like say the course, the things that you love to do, it would obviously be something which you'd probably be able to do in your sleep.
Yeah.
Yet, you know, but yeah,
I don't say that to brag, but yes, that's how my brain works. You know, like no emotion, no ego attached. I could probably write a how-to book pretty easily.
But yet it was the novel that you decided to go down. And so just take us sort of into that process and make sure everyone knows exactly obviously how the book formulates and that kind of thing. But I'm sort of curious about that because, like I say, it could obviously have been something different, but you decided to go down this route.
Oh my God, Mark, I adore your questions. Thank you. These are so fun. You know, it's interesting, right? Because I did. I struggled. I actually struggled with like whether or not to do this as a self-help book or a novel. And two big things. One, I don't want to be a guru. My experience is my experience. And if it helps, I'm so happy that it does. But again, there's a million ways to do anything. And so I'm not here to tell you how to do it or what to do. I'm just like, the book is a novel so that you have examples and stories and characters that you can grab a hold of who might be going through something similar emotion-wise, that you can see they come out of in a hopefully inspiring way. And the reason I did that was because it really is my story. I would say 90% of this book is actually things that happened to me. But so there is that element of like, well, if Jenna can do it, I can do it kind of thing. But it's told in a way that's relatable, hopefully, to teenagers because they're my heart. Like, I so want them to understand that they have more choice in their life than they think they do. That's the first reason. And the second reason is, to be totally honest, PTSD messed with my memory. So I didn't feel right telling a story about factual incidences because there's three truths to every story, right? And that's number one. And number two, I don't remember a lot of like the technical details of what happened. I remember the emotional details of what happened. And I felt like it was better served as a novel. Like she goes, Niff is the main character. She goes through a very emotional journey. Because I'm in film, I wrote it based on like a movie template. So it's an easier read because I was like, it's for high school students. Not all of them like to read, but I feel like the information in this book is really important. And so I wanted to make it easy to read, easy to like understand, and also relatable on an emotional level, not necessarily an experience level.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Really does. And I guess the next question would be, is it a movie? Could it be a movie? Could it be a TV series?
If Selena Gomez is production company or Drew Barrymore or Reese Witherspoon, I'm just saying, yeah, no, it totally could be.
Yeah. Fantastic. And the emotional thing is something which I find fascinating. And I think it's really, really important. And with that sort of educational bent, I mean, I don't know what your school experience was like, but you know, was there a teacher? Was there a situation? Was there an experience that kind of had an impact on you? How did that sort of set you up for what you did in terms of moving to LA, for example?
Oh my gosh, in the book. Well, first of all, I think I was really lucky to grow up with parents my parents were in a rock band and they played out almost every weekend. And so I had this incredible experience of seeing kind of like what people think of the musician life of being on stage with the makeup and the pyrotechnics and like huge shows, right? And then also the like really hard work it took to book those gigs. And so I that's what made me believe I could come to Los Angeles and actually make a career out of being in the arts. And I'm forever grateful for that experience. Like my parents didn't hide any of the pros or the cons, right? So I really had a great grasp of what it meant to be a working artist. That said, the inspiration part for my like creative soul came from two teachers, actually. Both of them have last names that start with M. And as I was writing the book, I realized I was starting everyone's name with M. And my editor was like, I think we need to like pull out a name list and you need to change some. But Mrs. Mink was my choir teacher and she was unbelievably inspiring to me. Just the ability to make me feel like I could actually sing and perform and all of that stuff. Like choir was my refuge in school, right? While I was there during the day. And then my English teacher, Mrs. Minky, was the first one who convinced me I could give speeches. And I'll never forget it. I think it was like seventh or eighth grade. And we had speech competition. And she's like, we need an extra person on the speech club. And I'm like, what? No, I can never give a speech. Cut to, I almost made it to state. And like all this stuff. And I went to college on a speech scholarship and now it's part of what I do in the world. And it's so much fun. So that changed my entire life, honestly. Teachers are just, you all. I have so much respect.
I think that bird's eye view is really important as well, isn't it? Because when you are a teacher, when you are in the sort of the grind of it, as it were, you know, you're having these conversations and you're infecting people all the time, but you never know what those moments are or those opportunities. You can have grand plans of maybe how it's going to do it, but it's that usually that one conversation. And like you said, it's about how you get, how you feel about a situation, whether it's, like you say, being given the confidence to do something new or a conversation or being seen, all of that kind of stuff makes a really big difference. And is there a piece of advice that you would give your younger self now, or a piece of advice that you were given that you'd like to share? But I guess we covered that in some ways, because the book is essentially a dialogue of that. But
I feel like it would be to develop patience. I'm a little bit impatient, y'all. It's not always the greatest thing. And also just to learn. I think we're told to learn so many things that we don't understand why. Like history, for example. Unless you're into history, you're kind of like, why am I learning this? But I would tell my younger self to explore the psychology behind the history and pull out the people who inspire me and really dig into why. Why is that person inspiring to me? You know, because everybody's inspired by someone different. And for me, like, I want to say this to the teachers too. It's like, I'm inspired by people who are excited about what they're doing. And those two examples I gave of teachers who changed me, they weren't trying. They didn't set out one day to be like, I'm going to change Jenna's life. They were just excited about their jobs. They were excited about what they were doing, and that excitement was contagious. And they then gave me an opportunity to participate in their excitement. And I think that that's the most important thing about being a teacher. And I think it's honestly the most important thing about being human, is like finding that thing that excites you and then figuring out how to share it by just being you.
And you really are on a journey together then, aren't you? Because then it's not about, I'm just giving you information, which, in the current day and age, we know is a nonsense from a school point of view with AI. Yeah. You know, everything at your fingertips. But it's that kind of, you know, we want to do this together. And that's why I think arts and sport are so important, because there is no way around that. You know, we're creating this game. We're creating this theatre. We're doing this play, whatever it happens to be. It has to be the here and now. And I guess that's kind of sort of brings me a little bit back into the thought process of the book, is the fact that you take people on a journey, there is a story there, but the actual relationship of what that's like for each reader is going to be personal as well, because what they relate to and what they reflect on is going to be based like a mirror to their life. So, there's a bigger story than even the one that you thought you were producing.
Oh, always. And isn't that the beauty of art? It's like everybody's going to get something different. And by the way, anybody listening, I am so curious about what you're going to pull out of this book. I wrote it with the intention of just like telling the most meaningful stories from my experience, but I've had the craziest experiences with some of the people that have been advanced reader copy readers, and they'll pull things out. Like somebody mentioned the friendship. So the Niff is the main character and she has two best friends. And there's this scene in there where, you know, they get into a little fight. And the way that they make up apparently is not the norm, but it's the norm with my friends and I. And I'm well out of high school, so I forget. And so, like, that was the most meaningful part that they pulled out. And I didn't even think about it. I was just writing it like a scene of me and my best friends. This is how we talk to each other. And so I was so excited to hear that, right? Because when you're writing or creating any art, you are doing it with an intention, but the byproduct can be anything, you know? And so anybody listening, if you read the book, please message me what your takeaway is, because I would be so curious to know.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that relationship and that kind of to and fro, because like I say, it's not just one dimensional then, you know, it's like we're all in this together, and it's not just about me reading a story. It's not about the internals, it's the external as well, which I think is fantastic. And is there another resource that you'd like to share? It could be anything from a podcast, video, song, film, book. Obviously, we'll mention your book at the end as well. So again, but
obviously my book, but we'll talk about it again. Exactly. But in all reality, to be honest, like the book that I go back to constantly is this book called Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. And I would recommend it to anybody, even if you're not like interested in the creative arts. She just has this beautiful way of explaining how to connect with yourself. And I flip and love it. And then there's obviously Harry Potter, which is near and dear. But I would strongly recommend reading Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. Have you read it?
I haven't, no.
Oh, Mark, you'll love it.
Excellent. So well, good. That's why I love this. There's so many recommendations, so many things which I get to shared with me that, yeah.
What's yours?
My favorite book?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's a very good question.
Well, you're the one that asked it, so of course it's a very good question.
I thought about various books that I sort of go round and round, depending on what it is that I'm doing. I quite like things which kind of make me think. I quite like the things which, you know, how to form friends and relationships. I like things which sort of make me sort of think intrinsically about life as well as a good novel as well. So a combination of all those things. But I think for me, part of it, I like some of the John Grisham books. And the reason I mention that now is because it was one of the things that kind of got me into reading post school when I wasn't interested about reading it post sort of school. But it was also, there's a certain time and a feeling about what it was like at that point finding these sorts of stories that I think has something which is sort of dear to me, as well as what you actually get from the book as well, which I think probably relates a little bit to what you've been sharing about your book.
Oh my gosh, I love that. Yes, it really is. So I'll read the same books, maybe like five of them, but it's at different points in my life. And I've noticed like they all say something different to me depending on what I'm going through, what my mood is. So I totally understand what you're saying. And sometimes like the book that I remember being the most inspiring, this happened to me with a couple of books. I read it again. I'm like, why did I love this book so much? And then I realized like, that's the beauty of growth. Right? Yeah. Like there's so many books out there for exactly where you're at in that moment, and then you outgrow them. And so instead of being upset about that, you should celebrate that. Like, oh, I'm not here anymore. Can you tell I love the self-development books? I really do. Oh my gosh. But I think that that's beautiful. And I think that that's also so important for us to really start to practice, is this like not judging where we're at piece. Like just acknowledge it. It's fine. Yeah. I actually tell this story in the book that is a answer to one of your questions, but maybe I should let you ask the question.
No, it's fine. Is it related to fire? Because we can move straight into that.
It is not related to fire.
Okay, yeah. Carry
it
on.
Is. Wait, where is it? Well, what was the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Yeah.
So in this context, in the book, I write about this. I ended up in the psych ward in the hospital. So it was bad, y'all. And there was this woman there. She was probably my age, so mid-20s at the time. And she checked herself in, and everybody knew who she was. And it was like she started decorating the walls with her chalk drawings and like all this stuff. And I was fascinated by her because she was in this place that I was fully judging myself for being in, even though I wouldn't have judged myself if I had to be in the hospital because I had cancer. Like I clearly needed to be there, right? And so I went up to her and I was like, you have like the best attitude about this. And she's like, oh, I'm just here for a tune-up. And I'm like, what? And she's like, I have bipolar disorder and I have to check myself in every few times a year just to regulate my medication, make sure that my body's doing what my body's supposed to be doing, make sure that my brain's doing what my brain is supposed to be doing and that I feel good. And the way she talked about it was just like, oh my God, I wish we could all talk about mental health this way. There was no judgment. There was no emotion. She's like, yeah, it's what my body does. It's how I am. And so her piece of advice to me was just keep swimming.
I love
that. Just keep swimming.
Yeah. I love that. And there was something that just reminded me from what you were saying just before that as well about the sort of the going back to the same sort of book or the same situation. I firmly believe that sometimes, especially if you've read a book before, there's something that's in there which wasn't relevant or you weren't able to cope with at the time. And then every now and again, you're just that kind of, I need to read this for some reason. Like The Power of Now is one of those from Eckhart Tolle that I go back to over and over. And it's that kind of, you read it again and you go, I'm not sure I would have actually heard that in the same way. And even though it's sort of the one philosophy, actually it does make that difference. And I think that there's something, I guess it's that inner intuition or whatever, however you want to describe it, but it's worth doing that. And then, like I said, it's a little bit like the, can I get out of town and move to wherever I want to fulfill my dreams? Everything's possible. You just have to, like say, be patient and wait for that to unfold as it goes through.
Well, and to go back to the very beginning of our conversation, what you were just saying about The Power of Now and reading the same book over and over, that's a tool that works for you. And so I feel like if we can give ourselves permission to explore things that work for us, we're just going to be a better society.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. And as we sort of start to wrap up, obviously the acronym FIRE is really important to us at Education on Fire. And by that, we mean feedback, inspiration, resilience, and empowerment. And I'm always just interested, what is it that strikes you when you hear those words?
Oh my gosh, I love that you sent this early because I was thinking about it for so long. And then I realized this is how all of my friendships are all of my industry friendships. Because film and TV and writing and the creative arts are such a collaborative effort, I feel like all of us who are in them for any amount of time get really good at giving feedback, inspiration, resilience, empowerment, just in a regular conversation, because otherwise you wouldn't be here. It's too hard of an industry, and like keeping friendships alive is just too hard when you're in Los Angeles, that if you don't have this kind of relationship, and that's actually probably the story we mentioned earlier with how the friends interact in the book is this. They gave feedback, inspiration, resilience, empowerment, all of it. And I think the key to this is to remove your ego when you're with your friends and build that trust, knowing if a friend of mine gives me feedback, which by the way, they totally did on the book, right? It wouldn't exist if it wasn't for FIRE. I have to know and trust that they are giving me feedback to make it better, not to discourage me, not to criticize, not to any of that. And frankly, that's on me. That's that radical responsibility part, right? Like we can't be offended when people are giving us feedback. And it's a lot easier if you build up a FIRE friendship. I'm gonna call it a FIRE friendship. You gotta find the people who can do
amazing.
That with you.
No one has said that before. And I think that's absolutely incredible because it's so important. And I love the fact it becomes a whole as well as an individual group of words and an idea, because you're right, they're all intertwined. And thank you for 100%. That. I absolutely love it. Oh, fantastic. Jenna, thank you so much. What a great way to round off. Tell people where they can find out obviously more about you and get hold of the book and get in contact, like say, once they've read it, to be able to give you some of their thoughts as well.
I would love FIRE friendship feedback, y'all. You can find me at jennaedwards.com. super simple. I am very active on Instagram, which you can also get to through my website, and you can find the links to buy the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all bookstores. In fact, if you want to go to your local bookstore and order it, you can do that right now, and they will be able to bring it in, which is so exciting for me. It officially comes out March 13th. If you want to join me in the launch celebration online, Jenna Edwards Official on Instagram is my handle.
Amazing. Jenna, thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating and so lovely chatting to you. I love your enthusiasm. I love everything that you're doing, and I love the right realness of it. It's absolutely brilliant. Thanks so much indeed.
Thank you so much.
I really hope you enjoyed today's conversation, and thank you so much for being part of the Education on Fire community. Links and details of today's podcast are in the description. And if you would like to support the show with a small donation, that's a wonderful way to help me bring you more creative and inspiring learning. Please visit educationonfire.com/support. And remember, education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire.